Welcome to the Life in Deep Ellum podcast, exploring the sacred in art, music, faith, and community.
Good morning, everyone. For those of you who don't know me or I haven't had the pleasure of meeting yet, my name is Bryson Hill. I'm the ministry intern here at LIDD, and I'm excited just to be up here with you all. And so if you haven't been here, you know, through our season of Lent and into our time of Easter, we're walking through a series in which we were looking at the life of Peter and kind of seeing the ministry of Jesus through the eyes of Peter and how we connect with that. And Annette did an incredible job of actually wrapping up that sermon last week, or that sermon series, I should say, last week. Got that finished up and done. And then next week, we are going to be starting a new sermon series. Jenna will be starting that, and we're very excited for that. But what that means for me is, for this week, I was given free rein as to, you know, what I want to talk about or what that will look like. You can always trust that LIDD will be an incredible hype crowd. So, so naturally, given free rein with anything I can do, I chose to continue the story of Peter and the disciples. It's just much easier that way. But what we're going to be kind of doing a little bit is I want to do a brief recap of some things we talked about through Holy Week and then introduce some things that have happened and kind of what we're moving into. Because in John 14, we saw some of this. It's walking through the Last Supper that Jesus has with his disciples. And in that, what I want to focus on is a lot of teaching that Jesus does about what's called the advocate or the paraclete, to use the word that sticks closer to the Greek. But essentially, he's talking about the coming of the Holy Spirit and what that will be. It's this promise that after Jesus is gone, someone will come later and empower the disciples to continue in the mission that Jesus has given them. So he comes and he speaks about all these things that the advocate will do and how the advocate will help with them. So we see that in John. That's the promise of the disciples. And then you move into Acts. And in the early parts of Acts, one of the first things that happens is Jesus ascends. So the disciples, after Easter, Jesus is resurrected. He appears to some people afterwards. He has some final discussions with his disciples, and then Jesus goes away, and he's no longer here, and the disciples are left a little bit alone until, you know, what is called Pentecost. So the next kind of major holy day for us is Pentecost. It's the end of the Easter season. Traditionally, it's 50 days after Easter, and that's understood as that's the day that the Holy Spirit came on the disciples, so the advocate came. And the exact timeline between, you know, the start of Acts and when Jesus ascended, and then however many days were from the ascension to the actual Pentecost isn't 100% known, but I do think that in that time, I think the disciples were waiting. And if you look at the actual day of Pentecost, they were together when the Holy Spirit came in. So they were waiting, and they were waiting together. But I can't imagine, you know, what that must feel like. You've spent time with Jesus. You've learned so many things. You've seen so many incredible things. And you were promised that someone else is coming after me. And then you gotta wait. You got to just sit there for a little bit, not knowing what it's going to look like. You know, I imagine when they came together, I bet there was a lot of kind of twiddling of thumbs, as you do, just kind of, Maybe there were some awkward conversations about, well, what do we do now? What's our next step? Who's in charge? We've been following someone and our leader is gone. What now? Maybe there were some heated conversations when people disagreed about what to do next. Maybe one thought one way, another thought another. But man, waiting can be really hard, can't it? I mean, am I the only one that even to this day still feels like that impatient kid on Christmas morning, waiting for the parents to wake up so that you can continue the festivities of Christmas, that impatient feeling, even when I'm not necessarily waiting on Christmas anymore? Maybe I'm waiting on something else. But I still get those feelings of anticipation, maybe sometimes some anxiety as well, of just not knowing, you know, what's coming or what to focus on. You know, sometimes in the waiting, I feel a little powerless. Because a lot of times, whenever I'm waiting and whenever a lot of people are waiting, you know, you've done everything you can in that moment. You've done everything to whatever it may be. You've done all the things, and now you just have to wait. And there's nothing you can do to make the time go faster. You just have to sit and be in it for a little bit. And you know, the funny thing is, in that time of waiting, as I talked about, you know, sometimes you're waiting for a really joyful thing. You know, maybe you're waiting to receive a gift that was promised to you or that you know that you're going to be given. Maybe sometimes the waiting is for what the next chapter is. Maybe you're waiting on that phone call after all the interviews, after all the rounds of, you know, whether or not you got the position. Maybe you're waiting on a really tough call. Maybe, you know, the tests went out, you know, the doctors were consulted, and you're just waiting on the results now, wondering what comes next. In all of that, there's so many feelings that come up. Again, the anticipation, anxiety, joy for the positives, fear, maybe. It's a real smorgasbord of feelings, I would say. I know I have that whenever I'm having to wait. And I know that not everyone is the exact same as me. Not everyone reacts to waiting in the same way. But one thing I do know is each and every one of us, at some point, has had to spend some time waiting, wondering what comes next. And in that moment, in that waiting, you sat in that knowing there was nothing else you could do. And that's just such a hard place to be in. Being somewhere where you have to do nothing because there's nothing to be done. It can feel powerless and you just want to change it. You know, it's in the midst of all of that waiting that kind of the inspiration for this sermon came in. You know, I'm in a period of waiting, of a bit of an in-between time right now. I've got less than a month until my graduation, which is very exciting. I also have no idea of what life will look like after that, which brings some anxiety with it. And I think that's why I find myself so connected, because just as the disciples, this time of Easter, in between, you know, Easter and Pentecost, the disciples are waiting for what comes next. It's really easy to connect with that idea, you know, for me at least, because I'm waiting for what comes next with no idea of what it will look like. And I say everyone has done this because, you know, very recently our very own Chris Norwood had to do some waiting. As many of us know, I asked him kind of what that period was like as he was waiting for his album that released a couple months ago. So I got to sit down with him and I got his permission to mention all this because I just wanted to pick his brain. Because something for you all to know as people prepare sermons and things like that is you can talk about yourself a lot, but sometimes people are tired of hearing you talk about yourself. So sometimes you need to reach out to other people and get their experiences and their stories as well. It was just really good getting to sit with Chris and hearing what he talked about, you know, what it was like waiting for that album to come out. He'd done the work, he wrote the songs, he edited, he did everything, and he was just prepping for that release show and what that will look like. You know, he talked about the worry he felt, obviously, because he put a lot of time and effort into this, so worrying about how the album will do, you know, how successful it will be, You know, worrying about the release show, what that will look like, how that will go over. He talked about how kind of in that, some things that he did to take his mind off the worry or the anticipation, the anxiety of the waiting was, you know, he turned to other projects. Maybe he started working on another album. Maybe he started taking up some other hobbies that he now had some time for, maybe kind of moving his way away from that. And that was interesting because as he was talking about that, I realized I'm similar in that way. And a lot of times whenever there's nothing else I can do for something, you know, I kind of have to just put that thing away. And what helps me is I focus on maybe other people or other projects. And while that one thing may be done, there are seven other things that I can do now and continue working on. So it was cool to see those similarities. One of the things that Chris talked about that really struck me as powerful and important that I need to work on better is, you know, we talked about something he does in the waiting is he visualizes a successful show. He visualizes, you know, a lot of people coming out, that the album's going to do great, and he creates kind of a mental image for that, which I think is really, really positive and a really cool thing to do while we're sitting in there wondering what to do next is maybe let's look at the positives. Let's look at all the incredible things that can come from this. You know, as I talked to him, I realized, like I said, we had a lot of similarities. We had some differences. Not everything was the same. And that no one approaches this time of waiting in the exact same way is what I saw. Even in the midst of doing all these things, though, of maybe turning to other projects, of doing all these hobbies or helping others, whatever that may look like, sometimes that doesn't always take the anxiety away, though, you know? You may mask it a little bit, but it's still there, right under the surface. So what do we do? You know, what do we do while we're sitting there and waiting? And unfortunately, you know, Acts doesn't give us a good picture of exactly what the disciples were doing. But I want to talk about, you know, another place where it does talk about waiting. And as I kind of introduce our text for today, I want to take a page out of Annette's book. She did something really cool last week, and I'm going to give you a fun little Bible fact. Some of you may not know what are believed to be the earliest written books of the Bible, which ones were the first written. There's two that are kind of go back and forth between most scholarship, and that's 1 Thessalonians and Galatians. So these two books of the Bible are considered to be written around 50 CE, so about, you know, roughly around 15 to 20 years after, you know, the ministry of Jesus came to an end and everything. There are two letters that are in the, most scholars also agree that Paul definitely wrote 1 Thessalonians and Galatians. So, you know, there's some fun little Bible knowledge that you can take out if you want, or you can completely forget it because why do you need to know that? But I want to be zoning in on 1 Thessalonians a little bit. And we'll be looking at the beginning of chapter 5 in 1 Thessalonians if anyone wants to you know, turn there. You've got your phones. If you've got a physical Bible, you can join me in that. I will also be reading it here in a little bit. But basically, I want to give some background on what 1 Thessalonians was. So it was a letter to a church in Thessalonica that Paul wrote in response to some questions that Paul was getting, mostly about, you know, a lot of the people had the idea that, oh, they talk about the return of Jesus, that's what we're looking for, that's what we're waiting for. Surely that's not going to be too far off, right? Like, surely we're pretty close to that. And as time kept going, and maybe some people that were very dedicated to the church started passing, they started asking questions of, what does it mean for these people, you know, that have passed? What does that look like? Why? What does the return of Jesus look like, really, is a lot of their questions. You know, they weren't expecting to have to wait very long for Jesus to come back. They weren't thinking they were going to have to deal with the question of what happens when people that follow the way die. They didn't think they'd have to deal with death a whole lot. So that's kind of what Paul is taking on in chapters 4 and 5 of 1 Thessalonians, is just dealing with this question of the return of Jesus and what that will look like. So I'm going to start reading now, beginning in verse 1, and I'll be ending it at verse 11. I'm reading from the NRSV, just so you're aware. But 1 Thessalonians 5:1. Now concerning the times and the seasons, brothers and sisters, you do not need to have anything written to you. For you yourselves know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. When they say there is peace and security, then destruction will come upon them, as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and there will be no escape. But you, beloved, are not in the darkness, for that day to surprise you like a thief. For you are all children of light and children of the day. We are not of the night or of darkness. So then let us not fall asleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober. For those who sleep at night and those who are drunk get drunk at night. But since we belong to the day, let us be sober and put on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet, the hope of salvation. For God has destined us not for wrath, but for obtaining salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build up each other, as indeed you are doing. So, there's obviously a lot going on here. There's some weird images and things like that. If I'm being honest, as a student, maybe it's just me coming this way, but I get some vibes that maybe Paul needed to pump up the word count a little bit. Maybe the letter was looking a little short, so he needed to add some things in there because there's some repetition here, kind of repeats himself. And if I'm being honest, I don't like to always do this, but I don't necessarily want to focus on what Paul is talking about when the day of the Lord will come or what that will look like. We can't know. We were told we can't know, and so I don't know if focusing on that is the, it's not what I want to do at least. So I'm going to look a lot at verse 11 here at the very end, which it starts with a therefore. And if any of my professors put anything in my head through any of my schooling, it's when you see a therefore, you have to ask yourself, what's it there for? So it's a good one, but I heard that from every Bible teacher I have ever had. So, because of that, I focused in on this verse and really started to have to ask myself, why is this therefore there? What's it doing? And as I continued to read this and looking at some other things kind of surrounding this chapter in chapter 4 and kind of continuing on in 5, I think what this therefore here is to point us to the main point of what Paul is talking about. Because not only is this kind of one verse here in 11, but just prior to this discussion, Paul ends chapter 4 by saying a very similar thing about calling them to encourage one another and build each other up. So this discussion of what the coming of the Lord will look like, what it will be like, how to prepare for it, is sandwiched between two calls to encourage one another. I think that's what Paul is getting at here. That maybe in the midst of waiting for the day of the Lord, for this thing that we cannot know but we need to be prepared for, maybe what we are to do in that time is encourage one another. Maybe that's what we do in the waiting. I felt a lot of ways connected to this. One, because of just this idea of to encourage one another in and of itself means you can't isolate yourself. You are actively seeking other people to connect with. And if any of you were here for my first sermon or have heard me talk at all, you know how much I love the idea of community and the importance and necessity of community. So I see that it's a call to be in community, to be with one another. Another thing about that I think is really beautiful and really important is to encourage one another is to take yourself out of the equation. So many times in the waiting, you're waiting on something for you, and there's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes taking that out and focusing on maybe some other people around you helps to cope and deal with that waiting. You know, Another thing about this that I just think is so funny and so interesting is, man, this is really simple, right? Like, Paul spends 10 verses here eloquently describing the coming of the Lord. You would expect that maybe the main point would be some deep philosophical or very difficult to understand concept, but it's not. It's one simple sentence. Encourage one another. Be there for one another, just as you have been. It's a simple response, and if I'm being honest, at first glance, I got a little upset with that, you know? It's like, no, there's got to be something more to it. It's got to be bigger than that. There's got to be something else. But it really is just that simple. Simple and beautiful. It's something we can accomplish, you know? A couple of weeks ago, I preached on Jesus and Peter walking on the water and talked about this idea of sometimes we want to feel that we have to be Jesus rather than be like Jesus. You know, we try and take on too much, more than we can do. But what we're called to do here, what we're called to do in 1 Thessalonians, everyone can do that. We can all encourage one another in the midst of waiting for whatever comes next, whatever that will look like. We can turn to one another, support each other, and love one another. When we've done all that we can do, we can ask everyone else, what can I do for you? So, using that advice, it makes it pretty easy for me to think of what the disciples did when they were together waiting on the Spirit. We knew, again, that they gathered together, because they were together when the Spirit came. I wouldn't think that this was just a weird coincidence that they hadn't seen each other and then all of a sudden they just came together in one room and lo and behold, that was the time that the Spirit descended. No, I think this was something they were doing daily. Being with one another, supporting each other, loving and caring for one another. Maybe some disagreements about what to do next. Maybe not doing it perfectly, but still doing it together. I would think that Paul probably got this idea from the first disciples. I would think that that's why he's doing it. Because the thing is being together in that waiting makes the waiting so much easier. While they're waiting, they can share stories and remembrances of what it was like walking with Jesus. They can remind one another of what Jesus promised, building each other up, ensuring that everyone is supported. They can talk in excitement of what life will look like when this promise is fulfilled. They build each other up through the anxiety of not knowing what was coming next. And then, when what came next came, they continued to support one another in the new works that they were doing. The encouragement in community doesn't stop when the new chapter begins. It continues through. What does this look like for us, though? We're not the disciples. We're quite a bit removed from that time. So how does this compare? What stories do we have of that? And I'll be honest, this first one that came to mind, it's a bit extreme. But it's an incredibly inspiring story about strength being given, of God working in ways that it's just truly not comprehensible. So someone who's really impacted my faith journey and that I've learned a lot from and tried to study as much as I can was a German theologian by the name of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I don't know if many of you know who he was. He died young. He's known for some really powerful works, one of which being The Cost of Discipleship, where he talks about just what grace looks like and what that is, and he combats this idea of cheap grace, it's very good. I don't want to talk a whole lot more about it because I will butcher it. Not only was he an incredible writer, he pastored a church in Spain for a time. He learned Spanish and many other languages in order to do that. He did many incredible things. But one thing I always admired about Dietrich Bonhoeffer was his determination to stand up for what is right, regardless of the consequences. So as I said, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German theologian. He was born in 1906. He had just come into his positions, he had finished classes, and he was a brilliant student, much loved in his universities. But just as he was starting to get out, the Nazi regime was taking over. And from the beginning, he saw the problems with it. From the beginning, he spoke out and was labeled an enemy of the state. There were churches in the United States, there were churches in Switzerland, there were people all over the world begging Dietrich to move, to get out while he could, because they wanted so much for his voice to be heard for years and years. But he knew his calling was where he was at. He continued to work in Germany. He started a seminary to educate students, but also in that seminary, he shuttled Jews to safety in Switzerland. He worked in the ways that he could, doing the things that he could. But his actions led to his arrest, ultimately. Through all of this, he was writing essays and sermons. It did not stop him. But I think the reason that this stuck out to me so much for this was the reality is Dietrich Bonhoeffer was killed days before his camp was liberated by the Allied forces. He spent roughly 18 months in prison, starting off in one, being shuttled to one further behind Nazi lines because the advance of the Allied army. He knew that something was coming. He knew that this wasn't normal. But he was killed on April 9th, 1945, and on April 23rd of 1945, that camp was liberated. And the incredible thing is, April 8th, 1945, was Easter Sunday. And on that Easter Sunday, a day before Dietrich Bonhoeffer was to go to his death, he preached a sermon. He led a service for those imprisoned with him. Not just him, but the guards as well. It was an open service. And there are stories of Bonhoeffer, even in the midst of his depression, of his dark times, being there for one another, trying to show that light, doing what he could to support one another. So, why do I share this story? One, it's a true testament of what we do in the waiting. The reality is Dietrich had no idea what was coming next. He had thoughts of what it could be, but he truly didn't know what each day would hold or what would look like. And in the midst of that incredible suffering, waiting for whatever the next thing would be, he loved and supported those around him. He did what he could to help those that he could help. Now, I want to caveat this a little bit. Again, I said this is an extreme example. Hopefully no one has to go through and do that. But the extremity of it points to the beauty of what it can be whenever you do step into that encouragement of one another in the midst of the waiting. Because sometimes that waiting is incredibly hard. Knowing that the next day might be your last, or it might be your last day in captivity. Not knowing, staying in that state of limbo of between pure joy and pure devastation. So know that that is a hero story. That is not a story that I'm calling anyone to emulate or try and do. That is an incredible story. So what about some ways that maybe aren't that major? Maybe we don't want to have to put ourselves in that situation to live into the words of Paul and to encourage one another in the waiting. What about some ways that maybe we're more inclined to experience here in Dallas, Texas? I get to turn to my wife as an example for this. So as I said, I talked to Chris. I also talked to my wife. I gave her a call on the phone. Another little insight into sermon planning is sometimes you go to someone expecting something to be a perfect sermon example, and then what they give you is the exact opposite of what you were looking for, and you say, "Thank you so much for all of your help. You're the best." Because what happened is I know how I handled waiting. I know what that looks like for me. And as I said, there are positives and negatives. There's some worries and things like that. But when I called Renique and I explained what I was talking about, what I wanted this sermon to look like, I asked her, "What do you do when you wait?" The first thing she said was, "Well, you know, honestly, I pray. I start praying a lot more. I'm like, cool, great. That one's not, I'm looking for some negatives. I'm looking for some not good things here. Come on, you're letting me down a little bit. She's like, well, you know, another thing I do is I look for ways that I can support other people. I look for ways I can help others. I'm like, okay, so basically everything I'm wanting to do in this sermon, you're already doing. Great, feeling real good about this one. Thank you so much. But it works out because while she maybe doesn't get to be the example earlier in the sermon, I get to talk about a true way of what that looks like. That it is, that praying earnestly and honestly to God in the midst of that waiting is something we can always do, trusting that God will listen and move in the ways that God will move. And it's an example of, the reality is I'm in a period of waiting, and she is in the midst of that waiting just as much as I am. Neither one of us knows what life will look like come May 13th. And we're filled with a little bit of anxiety, but also peace. So she is exactly what to do in the waiting. And that's not to say, I'm not putting her on a pedestal. She's not perfect. I don't want to say anything by those means. But that's an example of the here and now. Of we don't have to go and be a Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We can just be someone who prays earnestly and honestly. Who goes to want other people and say, hey, what can I do? What do you need from me? How can I help you? So, that's what we're going to do in the waiting. And to close out this sermon, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. You know, you got to practice what you preach sometimes. So I'm not sure what my life will look like in a month from now, as I've said. I'm in a period of waiting. I can't do anything more than what I've already done, outside of finishing the classes, of course. But as I'm sitting here and waiting, I want to send out some encouragement and support. Chris, your album is phenomenal. It is probably one of my favorite albums that I've heard in a long time. Life in Deep Ellum, you are an incredible group of people. The relationships that I've seen you build with each other, with me and my wife, have been incredible and life-giving. And I've loved getting to be a part of everything that you've been doing here. And I'm not done yet. So, maybe you're in this time of waiting. Maybe you are waiting on the news, waiting on a call, whatever it may be. Imagine what could happen if all of us who are waiting took some time today, maybe pulled up someone on our phone who said, I know they've been going through it. I know they've needed some support. Imagine if all of us who are waiting reached out and said, hey, I love you. You're doing incredible things. And then for those of us who maybe we're not in that period of waiting, maybe we're not there, but what we can do is we know someone who is. So imagine if those who are not waiting, who aren't in that period, reached out to those who were waiting and say, I see you. I see the work you've done. You're doing incredible things. This waiting will come over. You will get the news. You will get the call. Everything will be okay. Imagine what it looks like when we step out and support one another. We're all going to be waiting on something. So when you are, never forget. Encourage one another and build up each other, just as indeed you are doing.